You are listening to a session from the Sunstone 2013 Salt Lake City Symposium at the University of Utah. This particular session was recorded on August 1st, 2013, and is titled, A Study of LDS Believers' Orthodoxy versus Knowledge of Uncorrelated LDS Church History, presented by Amber Price. Sunstone depends on your generous support to fund projects like this podcast and other important endeavors in Mormon culture, scholarship, and restorationist pursuits. Please consider a donation at sunstonemagazine.com.
Hello and welcome to session 161 of the Sunstone Symposium. This session is titled LDS Believers, Orthodoxy versus Knowledge of Uncorrelated LDS Church History. It's with Amber Price. Amber is an undergraduate student in communications at Weber State University, and she finds how religion is discussed almost as interesting as religion itself. If you could please silence your cell phones for this session, that would be wonderful, so we don't have any interruptions. And with no further ado, I would like to introduce to you Amber Price.
Does that help at all? I'm a mom of four. I can talk really loud. Is that better? Okay. You know what I find even more interesting than religion is spelling. I just noticed that I'm missing an E. I've only looked over these slides like a million times. But I think they say it's a good thing if you get your most embarrassing part of your presentation out of the way to begin with. So I'm just going to start there and pretend like that was on purpose.
That just shows you're flexible.
Try this microphone. Maybe it'll work a little bit better.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes.
That's just recording. Okay. I'm going to hold it. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Just because I have a hard time staying in one place. So, my official title of my research project is called A Study of LDS Believers, Orthodoxy versus Knowledge of Uncorrelated Church History. But before we jump right into that, and there, I think, PowerPoint presentation is one different than mine, because this all works, I promise. All right, and I'm going to introduce myself. Not that you care that much, but sometimes I like to know who's talking to me before they start talking. And since I'm not, like, a notable Mormon scholar, I'm just...
Yes,
thank you. I'm just some lady who finds Mormons fascinating. I'm a Weber State student. Go Wildcats. I graduate in December with my... I think BS. In communications, my emphasis is public relations and advertising, which has nothing to do with Mormons, unless you want to be in PR for the church, which I hear is a good job. So I also have, I have four kids and a husband, and my husband should be here any minute now, I think. And I love narwhals. And if you don't know what a narwhal is, that's cool. I didn't know what a narwhal was till a year and a half ago. And one of the reasons I love narwhals is it reminds me that I have a lot more to learn. There's so many things on this planet that I don't even know are there, even if they are 700-pound whales with giant unicorn-like tusks. And they're real. They exist. So I just thought that was a fun little thing. And I also, some of you... might know me as Amber Peachin. I go by Amber Peachin on Facebook because I manage a bunch of sites and Facebook pages. And anyway, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So I have a professional page and a personal page. Anyway, so we're going to run through some quick definitions, which I think most of you are probably okay with, but I just want to make sure. In my research, I'm defining the church as the Salt Lake City core headquartered LDS church. So when I refer to the church, that is the one. Orthodox members are categorized as people, members who are literal in their belief of God, scriptures, prophets, and other doctrines and theologies in the LDS church, both in belief and in practice. Liberal members are those members who heavily nuance, well, I guess nuanced in some way, some heavier than others, one or more of their views of the church. Most of you, since you are here, likely fall into this category, or one of the following categories. The next are former members, and these are members who no longer believe in the doctrines and theologies of the LDS Church, regardless of their technical status, even if they haven't resigned. In my world, you get to self-proclaim what you are. So, and then the correlated church history is that church history and doctrine that's frequently covered in manuals, general conference talks, and other published magazines. They are the generally accepted teachings and beliefs of the church. So if you just go to primary and Sunday school and priesthood or relief society, that's what you learn. And then the uncorrelated church history is everything else. So topics that are infrequently covered, no longer covered, or found in academic works. And if I start talking way fast, just be like, whoa, slow down, because I talk fast anyway, and then I get nervous and I talk even faster. So, all right. So why this study? This all worked at 3 a.m. So this study is largely catapulted off of John DeLynn's study that he did a couple years ago on why members were leaving the church. And the top three reasons he found in his study from his respondents were: they lost faith in Joseph Smith, they studied church history and lost their belief, or I ceased belief in the church's doctrines and theologies. And the top doctrines and theologies listed were the Book of Abraham, polygamy and polyandry was number one. Number two was the Book of Abraham. Number three was blacks in the priesthood. Number four was DNA in the Book of Mormon historiosity. And then number five was Messianic influences, the temple ceremony. And number six was the multiple conflicting versions of the first vision. Now, John's study, I'm sure most of you have heard of that, right? Maybe not. In his study, he only talked to people who no longer associated themselves with belief with the LDS Church. So, since his study largely focused on non-believers, I thought, well, there's a huge segment that we could probably get a correlation but not causation kind of effect with. What about members? Are there members who know these difficult theologies and doctrines and historical events who are still active, believing, participating members in a traditional sense? So that's where we're breaking off the Orthodox believers from the liberal Mormons. And so, I wanted to find out if there was a correlation, a direct correlation in people who find out these issues, if they stay in the church or leave the church, how it affects their belief and their practice. So almost 2 years ago in a question and answer session at Utah State, I asked Marlon K. Jensen, who is currently the current church historian.
No, he's not.
2 years ago he was, when I talked to him. He's not right now, I know. But when I talked to him 2 years ago, it was before he was emeritus status. I asked him about Google's effect on membership. And his response was, we've never seen a greater state of, I'll call it apostasy, since Kirtland than we're seeing now. So I wanted to see if I could trace that apostasy directly to historical facts, or if there were, in fact, traditional members who stayed within the church who knew these hard historical issues. My other reason for this study was to win a bet. So, this is my friend Laura. She lives in Colorado. She is super smart and thoughtful. She's a ponderer, a thinker, a studier, a researcher. And I have her permission to use this picture as long as I use the hot one, she said. So, when I was an Orthodox Mormon about 3 years ago, and was agonizing over the effects of Prop 8, and I knew nothing of the uncorrelated history, my friend Laura and I talked to Laura about it, and she, being a liberal Mormon, suggested that, and I was struggling with the roles of prophets and the role of prophecy, and she suggested that I read Refstone Rowling, thinking it would help. And she was wrong. but she grew up in a family that discussed the uncorrelated history, lived a more liberal Mormon life growing up, and her parents were they are Sunstone Mormons, as I would define them. And she felt like faith was something that should be wrestled with. I, to counter with that, grew up in a very Orthodox letter of the law home. You didn't wrestle with faith, you just had it. And the more I learned about uncorrelated church history, the further I removed myself from active practice in the church. So I told her once when we were discussing these issues that I thought my experience was the more common experience within the church. that most people, when they learn the uncorrelated history of the church, do as I did, and they leave. And she felt like that her experience, she felt like her experience was more the common experience, and that we all have the capacity to find out these doctrines and histories and theologies that we've never heard before in our lives, wrestle with them, and come to a better place of belief, and remain the same kind of belief that we were before. So my hypotheses were born. So my hypothesis number one was that increased knowledge of the uncorrelated history of the LDS Church and Joseph Smith directly affects the belief in the literal teachings of the LDS Church. My hypothesis two, and I know you hate when people read off just slides to you, this is the only one I'm going to do it on. Hypothesis two is a change in beliefs due to increased knowledge directly influences participation in the LDS Church with an opposite correlate, with a negative correlation. So those are a lot of words and a mouthful. In other words, as your knowledge increases of the uncorrelated history, your belief changes and your participation will decrease. So this is a classic example of cognitive dissonance, which I know is a term that we throw around, at least in my world, we throw it around all the time. We talk about cognitive dissonance and refer to it offhandedly as cogdis, but it's actually a theory, and it's a communications theory. It's a theory in other studies too, but in communications theory, it means when our beliefs and our actions and our words and our body language and our behavior, because these are all ways we communicate, don't line up, we either change how we choose to understand what is in our brain and what is in our thoughts and our beliefs and the things we hold dear, or we change our actions to match what's going on inside of our head. So when I was trying to figure out how to measure this, I worked with one of my professors at Weber State named Yeon-Soo Kim, and we came up with a survey. And we decided that the best thing to do was to let people self-report their knowledge, belief, and activity their activity or participation within the church. So we'd let them do that, and then we'd measure their actual knowledge, belief, and participation within the church to see if their self-reported knowledge, belief, or participation matched up with their actual knowledge, belief, and participation. So for actual knowledge, there was a series of 22 questions. And these are an example of some of these questions. And this is called a Likert scale. That's a nerdy word. But so you have the ability to strongly agree, neither strongly agree or disagree, or to strongly disagree. Or you can say you don't know. And then we created a basis of measurement based on that. So, okay. So these measurements within the knowledge section were specifically set up to measure the things that John DeLynn found in his study were causing members, or that former members said caused them to leave. So they measured faith in Joseph Smith, church history, doctrine and theology, and then specifically there were several questions about polygamy and polyandry, the Book of Abraham, blacks in the priesthood, DNA of Book of Mormon, Messianic influence in the temples, and then the conflicting versions of the First Vision. Now, I just want to start off right now. This is not a perfect study. I have no illusions to the fact that this is perfectly done. I will say it's done to the best of my ability, and you will probably see flaws in it. And if you do, that's cool. Come talk to me. Send me an email like about 700 people already have. It's cool. I can take criticism. I no longer believe that I have perfect knowledge of anything. So, and then we measured actual belief. And actual belief measurements, all of the questions on these came from either the Temple Recommend interview questions, the Articles of Faith, or I pulled them directly from the Gospel Principles Manual or the Preach My Gospel Manual. I can't remember the name of that for some reason ever. And then our measurements on actual practice were just the things that you are supposed to do as a good Mormon. So how often, you know, do I attend the temple regularly? I read scriptures regularly. I pray regularly. I go to church on a regular basis. I tithe 10%. And then people could agree or disagree on this scale of how well the statement fit them. So it was a way of measuring a little bit more of the nuances rather than a solid, do you do this, yes or no? And same with the faith questions. And where they didn't have to say, yes, I believe, or no, I don't believe. Instead, there was a range. And And then the knowledge ones, I originally wanted to start with a true-false statement setup, and my professor convinced me to go the Likert scale route, and now I'm really glad because I have a really good answer for people who are like, that is not completely true or completely false, and I can say, well, that's why there's a scale. So, so who took the survey? There were 22,375 participants, about 2,000 of whom completed, answered every single question. So there are about 370, I think it's 374, I think it's 2001 that completed every question. There are about 374 who skipped a question or five or 10. We left their answers in, but it creates some problems with the percentages just for measurement scale stuff. So there were 50% of the respondents were female, 33.1% were male, and then 16.1% didn't answer. So... and then who took the survey or distribution? So I distributed it in a very non-scientific way, which is cool because I'm not publishing this as a dissertation or anything, and I'm actually using it as a pre-qualifier for further research that I want to do. So that gives me some more leeway. I sent it to everybody in my email box, in my contacts list. Everyone that I had since I had this email address like 10 years ago, regardless of where they lived, and regardless of what they believed, and I just said, if you're not Mormon, send it to somebody who is. And if you are Mormon, answer it. And if you are, and if you answer it, send it to somebody else who is too. And then I went to Facebook, because it's cool. And so I went to Facebook, and I published it in, and I put links in all of my groups. So, like, groups that I participate in full of ex-Mormons and angry atheists, and... We're loving people, and we put it, and I put it in groups that have more of a middle way of looking at things too. I put it in Feminist Mormon Housewives. I put it in a couple groups that have no affiliation with the LDS Church whatsoever. My local garage sale swap board in Davis County, and I just said, "Hey, take this if you're Mormon, or not if you're not. You know, it's okay." And then I also put it. I joined a bunch of groups. And it's probably not okay, but I did it anyway. And I joined LDS Chat Worldwide. I joined UK Singles. I'm not single, but they didn't seem to care. And I put in all of these groups, and I said, take this study, take this survey, give me some feedback. I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say. And the interesting thing was is that the super, super faithful groups who are super, super believers, their problems were not with the questions I asked. When I asked questions... Do you believe that Joseph, or did, I don't know, some of the harder questions. I worded them in such a way that when I asked the believers, they were like, I'm really offended that you would ask if I pay 10% tithing. Is none of your business how often I send the temple. And those were the problems that those people had with the survey. Now, the people on the ex-Mormon side and the former believer side, they had no problems either because, oh, and the believers too, I already knew all those answers. That wasn't hard. The ex-Mormon said the same thing. The people in the middle, the people like you guys who wrestle with your faith and wrestle with questions and see nuance and see the way you say things changes what it means, you're the people who emailed me over and over and over again. And the problems were, for example, I asked, one of the questions was, Joseph Smith was an uneducated farm boy. This is the question I got the most comments about. And you could strongly agree or strongly disagree or not know or anything in the middle. And I could tell how somebody felt about something by how they responded to this question. Joseph Smith was an uneducated farm boy, but that doesn't mean he was stupid. Joseph Smith was not uneducated. Just because you only go to school for 3 years doesn't mean that you're stupid. You can learn things, and you can be brilliant and con the world. And it depends on who it answered, how that went. So that was really interesting to me. Now, also, we have education level. Mormons are smart. I know you guys know this. You're all smart, too. But so most of the largest was four-year college degree. And then some college and master's degree were about the same. And I, since I just went back to school and I'm 34, well, I'm almost done, but I've been in school for like 3 years. And I think that those, in my mind, and this is me making it up, those are all moms who stopped to have babies and get married, and they're going back. And they're going to complete that. I'm just saying. Okay. So, and then... our missionaries were well represented. 34.5% served a mission, and 49.3% did not serve a mission. which plays in just a minute. And then, according to their actual belief, with 36.7 strong believers, 22% that were somewhere in the middle of belief, and then 40.8% that were non-believers, which I felt like was a pretty good sample size and a pretty good representation of equality as far as that goes. And then I threw the Pioneer Ancestry one in there, mostly because I find it interesting because I don't have Pioneer ancestors. Both of my parents are converts. But I find it interesting that in normal life, nobody talks about that, unless it's July, and then they talk about it ad nauseum. In Mormon studies, it is like the most important thing to say that your ancestors go back to the Willie Martin Handcart Company, or your ancestors were in Kirtland, Ohio, or whatever. So anyway, I'm gonna just quick spoiler alert. Whether or not you have Pioneer ancestry does not mean you know any more about the church or the history of the church. So 64.5% of the respondents have Pioneer ancestors. And then 28.3% have none, or they don't know. So, and then there was the unanswered. So, back to my hypothesis. Ease. I don't know how to say that in plural. So, back to my hypotheses. I lost my place in my notes. Oh, what did I find? So, my hypotheses were correct. And I wish that I'd bet Laura $500 or something. But I didn't. It's just the glory of being right. Which is honestly good for me. Good enough for me most of the time. So, when you break down how people did, pretending like they're in a church history classroom, and they have to answer these questions, the people who performed the best with the most A's were the people who were apostates. That's not good, right? So if you add up all the A's, B's, C's, and D's as a passing grade, which if you were my kid, that does not fly, but so you throw out the F's to see who passes at what rate. Non-believers pass with an A, B, C, or D 96% of the time. Middle believers pass 75% of the time, and strong believers pass 33% of the time, which is kind of sad, considering that they're the ones sitting in these meetings every single week. I broke it down even further. And let's be honest, my brother-in-law broke it down. He's a statistician, so he did this part for me. So, he pulled out those people who just reported saying they knew a lot about church history. So they reported their knowledge of church history, their self-report was a 6 or a 7, to see how if they did any better or any worse. The believers, actually as an A range, and a B range, and a C range, and a D range. Sorry, that's numbers. There you go. They increase. Their knowledge increases. So these are the percentages. So they increase all straight across the board, which is good. So those that think they do know a lot, but not that much more. So, and the apostates also improved. So if they went from 92% passing to 96% passing. And the believers, the middle folks, they also improved. So that follows just like you think it might. Now, and remember, these are the self-reported experts on church history. Now, let's look at the non-believers first, because there's a few of you in here. I recognize you. I have some words. So, their actual knowledge, the results show more about the way issues are communicated, rather than the truth or the falseness of the claims. I'm going to lay that out there right now. I think that I can hold a different belief on how I interpret the historical evidence of something than somebody else does, and we might, if we're both kind of in the middle rather than, anyway, you can have different beliefs and still be correct, depending on how you nuance it. So, the questions by percentage, this is the percentage. The believers are 43% correct. I already said that. I skipped this slide. Okay. All right. So, this is the total breakdown of the things, and these are the ones that we're going to talk about later. I know this is a huge thing and it's really small type, and I'm sorry. But if you want to print out, email me. So, I have the interesting questions. And this believers, or non-believers, is where I have my gripe with you. I can find no evidence whatsoever that says that Joseph Smith drank alcohol when he had his leg surgery. That story is told over and over again. Some of you might disagree with me. I might be wrong and have missed something. I admit that. But as far as I can find, this question, Joseph Smith had leg surgery as a child and drank alcohol to numb the pain, you should strongly disagree with. It's false. Right?
Right.
Okay. These ex-Mormons, who are so smart, got this question wrong 18% of the time. 122 of them got this question wrong. Their overall score was a lot better than that. This is the only question where believers do better than the non-believers. So this is what I say. This was an easy question, but your biases towards Joseph Smith throw you off. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that. That we don't discredit somebody more than they deserve to be discredited because of our feelings about them, and especially if we're trying to pretend like we know stuff, or we do know stuff and still get it wrong just because you're a little angry at the guy. So an interesting thing is, on a couple of the ex-Mormon boards, there were threads started about this question after they took the survey. I never knew that he drank alcohol during his surgery. So, ex-Mormons has their issues too. I'm just putting that out there. So, we don't have to vilify him more than he's already vilified himself, in my opinion. Now, for polygamy, is this a problem issue? Now, I always get told, when I say I was surprised by Joseph Smith's polygamy, I've always known that. And I hate that answer. I hate that answer so much. I thought for sure that members would get this question wrong. And they don't. They are correct 88% of the time. When the question, polygamy was not practiced by Joseph Smith, they get it correct. Joseph Smith was only married to Emma Hale Smith, they get it correct within 2 percentage points. So is polygamy a problem issue? Do active Mormons really know about polygamy? Now, side note, this went out about 48 hours after the Hans Mattson New York Times story. I think there might be a little bit of knowledge that was gained there, because I was talking to Mormons who are on the internet, which is a disqualification of my, or a drawback of my survey, is that I didn't talk to people who don't go online, and or if they only go online every 72 hours. I was up and down within 48 hours. I had enough responses. I had too many. My professor was not happy.
So did you know their ages? The ages of the people.
The ages of the people that know that.
That took the question.
Yes. I do. I have a longer answer that I'll get to. Okay, so the rest of the story, though, Mormons think they know about Joseph Smith's polygamy, but when I say, when one of the main reasons polygamy was instituted was to care for the widows and the women who needed help crossing the plains, their answers go down. Their knowledge goes down. They only get it correct 41% of the time. And then when I say this question, when LDS, I really only have 10 minutes left. I've got to fly. Okay, so when LDS people practiced polygamy, some men married other men, multiple women, but women did not marry multiple men. I was specifically getting at polyandry in this question, and they don't know that. So, So there's some other interesting questions that the ex-Mormons got wrong. They got the polyandry question wrong, too. So there might be a problem with how that question is worded. I've heard back from some people, like 100, that they didn't like that question at all because they felt like it was a trick question. So that we can account for that. Also, some of the other things... when we did these percentages, we took out these top two questions. The Book of Mormon is the most correct of any book on earth. That's more of a faith question than a knowledge question. So I threw that one out. Same with... Joseph Smith's teen persecutions. We throw those out because they were so vastly wrong. I felt like maybe they were more a faith question than a knowledge question. Now, the weapon in Carthage jail, Joseph Smith's education level, those were both high. And then, the Book of Abraham. There isn't much knowledge about the Book of Abraham, but that doesn't cause any problems, apparently. So, now, for my second hypothesis, does knowledge have a negative correlation with participation? Yes. those who pass our test at a higher level also go to church at a lower level currently as a self-reporting. That was the other thing we felt. Self-reported knowledge was vastly different than what was really there. Self-reported activity and belief actually correlated almost exactly. So people are honest with themselves and with random test takers on the internet of what their knowledge or their belief or their activity rate is. So this is a sad one to me. If you look at this, it looks like a funny scale because of the way the scale was done, but this is a higher level of knowledge, actual knowledge, grading-wise, and actual participation. So the more knowledge you have about church history, the less you participate. The less you have, the more you participate. So that's good to know. And then do return missionaries know more about church history? Yes. That's a good thing, right? They know more about Joseph Smith, Book of Abraham, polygamy, and race. They know more than people who didn't serve a mission. Interestingly enough, return missionaries scored better overall than anybody else, regardless of belief level. But serving mission doesn't affect your belief. You are just as likely, there's no significance in serving a mission into your correlate into how your activity in the church. So if you serve a mission, your kid serves a mission, means nothing. We know this now, but when I was growing up, 5 years ago, it was assumed that if your kid served a mission, they were golden for life. Same with if they go get married in the temple, that also has no effect on further participation in the church. And what about seminary? The belief level of people who graduate, the question was worded, did you graduate from a 4-year seminary program? And the options were yes, graduated, no, attended but didn't graduate, and no. If you graduated from seminary, your actual knowledge about race, Joseph Smith, polygamy were all higher. There is no significance in knowledge about the Book of Abraham. The interesting thing is, if you go by belief level of seminary graduators, people who graduate from seminary have the highest belief level currently. People who didn't attend have the next highest. And there's a significant difference in those who attended but didn't graduate. Their belief is the lowest of the three, not those who didn't attend, which is kind of interesting, but maybe accounted for people who are converts and their belief level, but they were converted after the seminary years. So, and this is our knowledge versus education. And I'm going to cruise through this. The higher education you have, the steeper your decline when you learn church history, the faster your belief level plummets. Now, this line here, the smallest slope, that's the only math word I know, the people who didn't graduate from high school. And the people who didn't graduate from high school, that looks like a huge, huge thing. But I'm going to tell you right now, there were only 10 of them, and they were still in high school. So I'm going to not count that line. So there were a number of teenagers who took the test, and a 4-year-old, but I threw out his responses. Okay, and another thing I wanted to check was knowledge and income. If you're in, what was the effect of knowledge of church history, your activity level, depending on your income?
Correlation, not effect.
Sorry, thank you. Correlation. The correlation is the higher your income, the less you need the church when you have gained knowledge, or when you learn more about uncorrelated history. Which there's some things you might say about that. I just find it interesting. So, but their knowledge scale and their income scale and their belief scale they're about the same. There's a short little uptick, but it seems to have a downward effect. So some other tidbits. Men have more knowledge about church history than women and a lower belief, as follows with our hypothesis. The more children you have, the higher your participation in the church, regardless of belief level. Which says a lot. Mostly probably, I would guess, and this is just speculation, I have no evidence for this, it's just anecdotal, you need the support system. If you have 7 kids, you can't afford to just leave if you live in Syracuse, Utah. And the beliefs with the highest influence of participation was having a testimony of Joseph Smith. That was the highest belief with the most influence by like double. Next was the temple, then the priesthood, then God. So that's actually a little telling. The most important thing for somebody to have a testimony of to participate in the church is a testimony of Joseph Smith. So what does this all mean? Aren't they just beautiful? So their information is out there. The more information that people have and how they gain that information is important. The next step of my survey is actually to find those 22 people who were high believers and high participators with high actual knowledge of church history, and to interview them and do a qualitative study and find out why. And why they're the exceptions to the rule. But I think how it's communicated is also important. If it's communicated younger, your kids will probably believe longer, if that's important to you. There's also the transparency effect. And then it's important to note that the people who say, I know everything about church history, and I still say, don't. And I think we already know that to a large extent, but when somebody says, I know Joseph Smith was a polygamist, if you are somebody who might be doing that, trying to encourage them to leave the church, you might say, but did you know he had 11 wives that were married to other women, other men at the same time? Yeah. If you were somebody who would do such a thing, I don't know, anything like that. But if you're within the church and you want people to stay, they need to hear that from somebody who is a trusted gatekeeper that they trust, so it's not something that is scary or they feel deceived later on. It's inoculation, I think, might work. I don't know. We'll see if it ever happens. So, and then how we participate was the decline wasn't they find out the information and they leave. It's they find some information and some more information and some more information and some more information, and then their beliefs and their participation change at that rate. So, and then the all or nothing rhetoric and fear of the wrong story being told will be the death of the church, in my opinion. People can adapt if you're honest with them. People will accept the stories if they hear them from you. But you have to make space for them. And obviously, when I say you, I don't mean you. You guys are the people who want this to happen. But the church needs to make space for people who understand the history and want to live it nuanced and want to still participate. Because in my view, and this is just anecdotal evidence, people are being pushed out when they're not traditional Orthodox believers. The church needs to make a firm statement that that is not okay, or they are going to lose people in mass numbers. So, and then narwhals. We all have something to learn. If I didn't learn until I was 33 years old that narwhals existed, then there's probably a lot more about church history that I don't know, too. And when we tell people at church that they're hearing the whole story, and then they go find out that it's not, they're going to be just as excited about church history as I was about narwhals. Still am about narwhals. And they're going to go find their own information using Google. Not the one through LDS.org, not the safe one. They're going to go to regular Google because they're 15 and 16 and 17 and 32 and 35. This is if you want to contact me. This is my blog. And I will be publishing or posting, I think it's posting is the technical term, some more information about this, maybe this video, some other stuff as it comes up on my blog here. If you want to find me on Facebook, I'm Amber Peachin. And then my email address is amberprice4398@gmail.com. If you want to email with any questions, concerns, if you want to yell at me, if you want a copy of the survey so you can see it, I'll send that to you as well. And then you can find me on LinkedIn on Amber Price because I don't have a job yet. So, you know. I think that's all. I think, am I within my time limit? Okay. Are there any questions?
Go ahead and take questions, and if you could just repeat the questions into the microphone so that they get recorded, that would be great.
Okay, can we start with the age question?
Yeah, I wondered if that was skewed, if it's skewed down.
The way that I accounted for age was not a good way to do that, to check for differences. So the answer is, I don't know. That's one of the things I want to find out, because I think the age you are when you find out the information makes a difference. I think my theory is my hypothesis, and we see how good I am with good hypotheses, right? Is that if you find out the information one piece at a time before the invention of the internet, if you find it through Sunstone magazines or Dialogue magazines or conversations with your grandfather or something, and you've learned that about polyandry, for instance, but you don't have anything else to learn about other stuff yet, and you wrestle with that and figure it out and figure out an answer that works for you, or you stop thinking about it and you put it away, and then 10 years later something else comes along, and I don't know, maybe this is a false hypothesis, but I think people who go to Google and say, holy cow, Joseph Smith had 33 wives I never knew, and then find out 5,000 other things within 3 days, they're gone next week. They don't show up for that second week of sacrament meeting. They don't do it. And so I'm gonna like transpose all those numbers and figure that out, but I haven't done that yet. So if you email me,
are you saying you have ages for
this? I have ages. Oh, okay. They weren't entered in an easy, accessible, statistical way to analyze them. Yes.
What about marital status?
Marital status, I have that. The breakdown was if you were married, sealed in the temple, just married, single, divorced, widowed, those were the options. There were no statistical differences in any of those on belief, on knowledge, on behavior, none at all. The only statistical thing we found that it doesn't matter if you were married in the temple or not, you can stop going to church just like everybody else. So, yes.
It does seem to me like source of information is really important. If you get it from a trusted BYU professor, or from a family member, or from a ward member with whom you have a close relationship who can help you through the faith issues, that's a lot different than finding it on Google on some, you know, ex-Mormon or anti-Mormon website, right?
And those are not the same thing.
Right.
I just have to put a plug in there. I agree. I think the source of information in communication studies is called having a gatekeeper. If you have a gatekeeper who is slowly releasing information to you and you're learning it, then it's not as scary. For instance, if I was to tell you that Joseph Smith used seer stones attached to a breastplate with these funny glasses, and he translated the Book of Mormon, which was written on gold plates he'd never seen before, and he couldn't read Egyptian, and he wrote the Book of Mormon, and it's fabulous and wonderful. And if I told you that at the age of 3 until you were 47, you would never think it was weird. But if I tell you that story your entire life, and then at the age of 32, you say, South Park knows more about the church than I do, then you're not going to trust the church leaders anymore. A quick anecdotal story. I invited my bishop today. I don't see him here. So, Mike, if you're here, I'm sorry. When I first struggled with these issues, I went into my bishop and I said, I asked my institute teacher, because somebody told me about seer stones, and I asked an institute teacher, and he said, there is no truth to that whatsoever. It is completely false and anti-Mormon propaganda. And this was when I was 19 years old at Institute in Las Vegas. And I trusted him, and I didn't think anything of it. If at that moment he had said, well, there is, and this is what it's about, and this is what, you know, and why you haven't heard about it, and, you know, it probably wouldn't have been a big deal. But since I found out at 32 that the institute teacher either didn't know or didn't tell me the truth, that was a huge thing for me. And when I went and talked to my bishop, and my bishop said to me, your institute teacher, interrupting me in the middle of my story, your institute teacher is absolutely correct. There is no truth to that whatsoever. It's anti-Mormon lies.
Oh, no.
The Spirit is bearing witness to me right now that this is the case. And I said to him, the Spirit disagrees with Russell and Nelson, the Ensign and the Friend magazine. And he still didn't believe me until I sent him those articles. And then he still didn't believe me and made it a source of fasting and prayer and has a testament of Joseph Smith and doesn't talk to me anymore. So I'll take that back. He likes my pictures on Facebook if they're appropriate. So I think the gatekeeper thing is a big deal. If my institute teacher had said that, if in primary we had pictures that represented the actual way the Book of Mormon was, the gold plates were translated, supposedly. If we were teaching the kids from the time they were this big, oh yeah, Joseph Smith had 33 wives, no big deal, everybody's doing it. Sorry, I'm being snarky, I should stop. So when they, I don't think it matters as much, but it does, it matters when you feel lied to and betrayed. So, yes.
I just want to say, I had the missionaries over for dinner 6 weeks ago in Draper, South Salt Lake Mission. I asked, what is the number one problem in the mission? They said, anti-Mormon literature. And I said, what does your mission president say about that? And he said, it's all false. Don't believe any of it. It's just not true. So that was the response from the mission president. This is right now in Salt Lake, how the missionaries are being told this.
And if you go on Mormon.org chat, I don't know people who do this, but if you do and you talk to the missionaries and you ask them if Joseph Smith had 33 wives, they don't know the answer. And they're told not to Google and they're told not to look. So, yes.
What about other reasons for leaving the church, like they really don't want to pay tithing, or they're gay, or, you know, other reasons for leaving the church that don't, I mean, that might lead one, for example, to search the internet and see, what is the deal with this Joseph Smith? He can have 33 wives and I can't be gay. You know, I mean...
It's a choice.
I mean,
the wives were a commandment, being gay is a choice.
She's got the answer.
How much are these things, the belief, correlated with other issues?
My study doesn't really go into depth with that. Have you read John Boleyn's study, Why Mormons Question, or something like that, .org, you can find it online. If you send me a whatever, I'll send you a link to it.
Sure.
Those are reasons. I think, though, from what he found in his study, if I'm remembering correctly, and if I'm quoting John's study wrong, then he can smite me later, that those are initial issues that cause people to be uncomfortable. And then they find out the other issues, and are like, I'm uncomfortable, and it's not even true. And I think that's kind of how he found it. His top reasons were all historical, and they were historical and doctrinal and theologically based. Those were the top reasons. Those other reasons are down there. But I think that why you get uncomfortable and even search for more information is one thing, but why you actually leave is the information that you find.
Oh, I just have to make this comment because years and years ago, one of the apostles gave a talk in conference and said the reason that people don't go to church is because they don't can't live it. And I never knew anyone to leave because they couldn't live it. That's not why my friends left.
You're offended, you're lazy, or Satan has a hold of your soul. Those are the reasons I've been told. So, yes.
Have you thought about going back and doing the survey again, reverting some of the questions that were problem areas, and finding people who have not taken it, and then have half that are internet savvy and half that are not internet connected, and doing the same thing again, because I don't know if it's too much work for you, do the same thing again, correct some of the problems on some of the questions that seem like they went wrong?
Since this is a screener survey that was largely done so I can do a qualitative study later, and a qualitative study, so a quantitative study, you ask 2,000 people questions and get mass numbers of data and stuff and analyze it and figure out what the problem is. Qualitative data, you find those people in your survey that match the qualifications you want and are willing to talk to you, and you interview them. And you ask different questions, and you get more of an actual feeling, so you'll do like 30 of those. And that's what the direction I'd like to go. I have thought it would be interesting to have paper copies of surveys or have a survey on a tablet, and talk to people who don't frequently use the internet, random sampling from around the country. I feel like what's missing is a lot of people's experiences who live outside of the United States. I got a few responses from Canada, from the UK, from Australia. All English speaking, obviously, since my survey was in English. And their experiences can be completely different than our experiences within the United States, specifically within the Morador here. So that is an interesting idea, though.
Did you calculate any significant differences between those findings to determine if they're statistically really different or they just look different on the chart?
If I statistically analyze the findings, I put them all through a program called SPSS, which is a statistical analysis program. So I only talked to you today about the things that there was a statistical difference for.
Thanks.
Yeah, their p-value was less than 0.01 or 0.10 or whatever it is. Yes?
Hey, you mentioned geography. What about within the United States? Is there differences based on living outside of Utah?
That is another question that I did not format correctly for the analysis program to find out. That's something I'm planning on going back and doing, is finding if there's a difference between people who live within, from Lethbridge down to Mesa. If there's a difference in those people's answers versus the people who live in California versus the people who live in you know, Washington, D.C., and I did ask on the survey where they grew up versus where they live now, because that's something I want to analyze, but this is my first large-scale project, and I goofed that one up, so.
You know, the leg surgery question pointed to, for me, to a problem in the questions that you provided, because if almost all of the questions were of a challenging nature, you might have somebody who's left the church who would just assume that the worst possible answer is the right one, and so they might look smarter than they actually are. And the fact that so many of them got that leg surgery question wrong, you know, might...
18% of them aren't as smart as they look, is that what you're saying? I'm not one of those, I don't think. That's a good point. That's a really good point. This was a kind of dirty survey as far as the way it was tabulated and accounted for, because it is the first step in a larger project. And there would be other ways to do it a little bit more scientifically than I have done it. But I think that it doesn't negate that the overall results are telling. But there are dumb ex-Mormons. I agree. Yes?
Have you thought about in the future doing this and correlating personality steps using Big Valley personality survey? It seems like believers and non-believers, believers is a dichotomous.
Have you read The Believing Brain by Michael Shermer?
No.
You should. Maybe it's The True Believer.
Oh, I read The True Believer.
Okay, The Believing Brain, then that's the one by Michael Shermer. No, I haven't thought about doing that. I do think there's a personality type. That's just casual observation. But I also think that sometimes it's the dichotomy that you're set up with since the time you are in nursery. The church is absolutely true, and you know this, and you're told you know this from the time you're this big. And if you ever deviate from saying I know and saying I believe, that word doesn't sit well with people. So I think it's almost a dichotomy that's shown in other ways. And I find it amazing people I talk to who are believers and who are such good critical thinkers. And they're so smart. And they think critically about everything they do except for the church. They don't think, and I don't mean that in a bad, like I don't mean that to be like, rude, or I can't think of the big word I'm thinking of right now, I'm trying to say, but I'm not saying it to be mean. I'm just saying that I think that if you are taught from the time you're very, very little that you don't think bad things, and anything not taught in primary is bad, if you don't think bad things, that you don't think bad things about the church, then I think it makes a difference in how you approach it as an adult, if you're taught that from a very, very, very young age. That would be my, and so I don't know that it's necessarily personality type as far as it's what is taught from a very, and I'm willing to be wrong. So, in the back.
Hi, Amber.
Hi.
This is kind of a comment about when you say I know instead of I believe. When I was about 8, I remember my testimony in my journal. And then going through and crossing out all the no's and I believed instead, because I wanted to be more accurate and honest.
At 8?
In my journal. Yeah.
You were 8, okay.
Well, that's how my brain works.
No, it's cool.
And my mom later found and read my journal, and she got kind of upset. She's like, Hillary, you should say you know these things. And I was really, really bothered because I was just trying to be honest. And it was just this thing that caused turmoil for years because I didn't know how to say, well, no one can ever really know something. So, anyway, that wasn't really a question.
That's sad. I'm sorry. I'm glad you're here because that means that you have moved past that. I don't know how to say that in a less in a more polite way, but I mean it in a polite way. And then I think we have two more questions, and then we need to be done.
I was just going to say, as far as the personality type, on an internet discussion group back in the early 90s where there was only one or two, so it was pretty much everybody was on the same group back in those days, they asked, what is your Myers-Briggs personality type? And there's a large percentage that were INTJ. It just seemed that was the kind of people that were drawn into these intellectual discussions. So for whatever that's worth, that seems to be one of the personality types.
And I think Holly.
Yeah, I like what you said a little bit a while ago about being taught a particular attitude towards the church, and I think that might be the real inoculation and not the information itself. I'm one of these people who, you know, we discussed polyandry in seminary. I just knew a lot of this. I had a great-grandfather who left over the Mountain Meadow Massacre. My dad liked to talk about how John Dealey's body had sat for years in a hotel basement half a block from the house he grew up in. And I always thought, that's so goofy and kind of icky and all these things. The thing, so it wasn't the information itself, it's that there was, it's that my parents were fairly critical. And I know other people, and people who had similar levels of knowledge to me, they left too because they were told they could be critical. It's the ones who grew up knowing this stuff, but being told, you think about the church a different way than you did anything else. So if you can ever find a way to quantify that in your study, if you can find a question, come up with a question about, well, you know, in my home, we did not criticize the church, something like that. That might be really useful to you.
As anecdotal evidence, my friend Laura grew up in a house like that, and I did not.
Right.
And our places that we're at right now are very different.
Right.
Even though we still love each other.
But what I'm saying is I'm another anecdote.
Right. I bet a large portion of the people in this room probably grew up in homes like that, which is why you're here. Right? Rather than at the fair conference down the road. No. Or rather than being, you know, not even thinking that there is things to go to, ever. Like, I would have never even thought of attending an academic Mormon event. I was done with Mormonism by the time three hours on Sunday, plus a meeting here and activities and whatever. So, the energy I didn't have. So, fast?
Yeah.
Okay.
To defend my tribe, the question about Joseph Smith and alcohol, what I think might have happened is people started reading the question and they reinterpreted, did Joseph Smith ever drink? Then they marked, yes, they knew he did, and they didn't really think critically, did he drink as a small child when he was having operation?
Possibly. There was another question that directly hit on that, though, that directly hit on, after the revelation of the word of wisdom, did Joseph Smith ever smoke or drink alcohol? So, I don't know. I don't remember the order of the questions. So, but it's possible. It's hard to say what everybody's thinking. I'll just pretend like I know. Thank you so much for coming up today.